Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unfolding nuclear catastrophe in Japan and speak with Gordon Thompson, the Executive Director of the Institute for Resource and Security Studies, who is an expert on the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technologies. Then we'll be joined by a leading authority on the generation and delivery of power to large populations, David S. Freeman, the former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the LA Department of Water and Power. He was also the state of California's energy czar. We will look into the future of nuclear power in America and the available alternatives, if indeed this latest accident reverses President Obama's promise of $36 billion in loan guarantees for new nuclear plants. Then finally, we'll talk with a former Libyan diplomat who was a translator for Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Dr. Abubakar Saad joins us to discuss the consequences of a possible victory of Gaddafi's forces and what can be done to prevent that from happening, along with the further slaughter of civilians in Libya. I'm now joined by Gordon Thompson, who is the Executive Director of the Institute for Resource and Security Studies in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's also a research professor at Clark University's George Perkin Marsh Institute. One of his major interests has been the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technologies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Thompson.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. And at this point, there has been a third explosion at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex, this involving number two reactor. So we already have had number one blow up, I believe, on Saturday, number three blow up on Monday, and now apparently number two has blown up. And a spokesperson for the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, said that this number two is even worse than the other units. So what's the latest information that you have, Gordon Thompson?
Well, information is sketchy and conflicting, but it appears there's significant core damage at each of the three units you mentioned. The release of radioactive material at present is quite small compared to the amount contained in the reactors.
So at this point, the explosions are caused by the hydrogen, which I understand comes from the fact that the metal cladding around the fuel rods is melting, and this is a byproduct. But that would indicate already a level of meltdown is underway at all three.
That's correct. The fuel cladding is made of zirconium metal, which reacts vigorously with steam at high temperature and produces hydrogen gas. So the fact that this large amount of hydrogen gas exists demonstrates that the fuel has become substantially overheated, and it's likely that some of it has melted. The hydrogen was released first from the reactor vessel into the containment vessel which surrounds it, and was then released into the reactor building and exploded.
Well, apparently at the Fukushima plant, the operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, have said that the fuel rods in the number two reactor had been exposed when water levels suddenly dropped due to an engine-powered pump pouring in the water that ran out of fuel. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible given the gravity of the situation that that kind of Murphy's Law could still be in play.
Well, if that is indeed the case, then that suggests a degree of disorganization that's a little surprising. But as I mentioned at the beginning, information is fragmentary and conflicting. So it won't be till after all of the dust has settled and there's a full inquiry that we'll know exactly what happened.
But we can assume, I imagine, Gordon Thompson, that given the exposure of the cores at these three reactors, that working on site is hazardous. And if you're pouring seawater and boric acid in, that would apparently corrode the instrumentation for the on-site monitoring. So it seems to me that there are two serious degrading factors here. One, the extent to which manpower can be on site to deal with it, and two, the damage to instrumentation.
Yes, you are exactly correct on both of these points. I imagine the site is highly disorganized. I'm sure it's very, very tense. The water is being supplied by portable pumps and perhaps fire trucks. Everything is irregular. This is an industry that normally goes by the book. There are detailed procedures for doing everything. The water that's used in these plants is purified to an extreme degree. So the fact that they're using seawater at all is symptomatic of the fact that the entire culture has been thrown into complete disarray. And I'm sure that the operators are groping for their next step. They've really gone to the limit of any procedure that would have been rehearsed.
And Gordon Thompson, the number three reactor apparently is fueled, it burns mixed oxide fuel, MOX, which contains plutonium. So if there's any release from that one, then surely that has serious consequences.
Well, the consequences would be serious if a release occurred from any of these reactors. You're correct that unit number three has some MOX fuel, some plutonium-containing MOX fuel. And if there is a release, there would be some greater consequences as a result of the MOX fuel.
And what do we know about the state of emergency that was declared yesterday at another plant at Onagawa? I haven't heard anything since yesterday.
Yes, I don't have information on Onagawa. I have a fair amount of information about Fukushima Daiichi.
Is there anything more you can share there? Because I think information is often hard to find in the midst of a ongoing catastrophe.
Yes, well, there are lots of general lessons about the nuclear industry, and perhaps it's best to address those lessons once this incident is resolved one way or another. But the incident could continue for weeks. The cores of these reactors produce heat that declines slowly but still will be significant for many days to come. So we may not see a quick resolution.
And what about the general assurances that the proponents of nuclear power give about built-in redundancy? It just seems on the surface a little hard to believe that in a country with a history of earthquakes and tsunamis that these backup facilities would have been knocked out so easily.
Well, that actually raises a fundamental point about this industry, which is that the designs are, shall we say, optimized at a cost level that the industry feels is reasonable from their perspective. So there are always design options that could provide a greater level of safety, but the industry has chosen what it believes is a cost-effective design, and the regulators have accepted this as a design with an acceptable level of risk. So what we're seeing is a set of circumstances that go beyond the design envelope for these plants. In the jargon of the industry, what we're seeing is a set of beyond design basis events. So the plants were simply not designed for events of this nature.
And there are 31 similar plants in the United States, I believe, to this GE design light water reactor at Fukushima.
Of a roughly comparable design, that is correct.
Which goes back to the 1960s.
Indeed, yes.
So this I suppose an example of what you just told us, Gordon Thompson, is apparently that the venting that's underway of the steam that is radioactive, the Europeans and the Scandinavians apparently have installed filters in such an eventuality that would filter out radioactive particulates under these circumstances. And apparently the U.S. and Japan and other countries have decided, the utilities have decided that's too expensive.
Yes, some reactors do have filtered venting pathways. However, there is no commercial nuclear reactor anywhere in the world that has a containment designed to accommodate a core melt accident. So plants vary in their ability to withstand a core melt accident, and to some extent they can be retrofitted to improve their capability in this respect, and some of them have been. But none of them were designed from the beginning for that purpose.
And that sounds rather extraordinary. And what would the reason for that be, or is that technically too high a bar?
No, it's perfectly possible. It's partly a question of cost, and it's partly that this is a very conservative industry, and also that many people in the industry believe that accidents are very rare and essentially almost impossible events. So there have been many regulatory proceedings where industry has fought very hard to continue using their original designs. And to some extent, regulators have fought back and demanded modifications, but only to a limited extent. And we're really seeing the outcome of that process now.
Well, that sounds, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, absolutely extraordinary that there are technical means available to prevent the worst possible outcome. And we had a partial meltdown at Three Mile Island, a full one at Chernobyl, various other smaller incidents in the earlier years of nuclear power. And now this one, that's where three nuclear reactors are in various stages of meltdown, and we're not quite sure of how grave it is in all three cases, except that we're told that the latest one that just exploded, number two, is worse than number one and number three. I'm just stunned that that's the case.
Well, just a little anecdote to illustrate. Alvin Weinberg was one of the pioneers of the nuclear industry in the United States. He worked with Admiral Rickover to develop submarine propulsion reactors, and then for many years headed the Oak Ridge National Laboratories. And around 1980 or so, Weinberg decided that if there was to be a new generation of nuclear power, the plant should be redesigned to have a much higher level of safety and a much greater degree of resistance to malevolent actions as well.
You mean like terrorist attacks and things like that?
Indeed, yes. He put a fair amount of effort around that time, about 30 years ago, to try and convince the industry to go in this direction, and was essentially ignored.
And, of course, this is an industry that wouldn't exist in the first place but for the Price-Anderson Act that indemnifies nuclear power utilities in any accident and puts the burden on the taxpayer.
Well, that's correct. This industry would not exist in a totally free market situation.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Gordon Thompson.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Thompson, who directs this Institute for Resource and Security Studies, and he is his research and expertise is in the environmental and security impacts of nuclear technology. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with one of the leading experts in the world on the generation delivery of power to large populations, David Freeman. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter. He also headed the New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Ian, it's always a pleasure to be in your voice company.
Well, this is not the
company as well.
Well, this is not the best of occasions in terms of the unfolding tragedy in Japan.
That's what you usually call me, yeah.
Well, so I just got through talking to somebody who's an expert on nuclear power and its environmental and security implications, and he was saying that for the longest time there have been proposals to prevent meltdowns at nuclear power plants. No nuclear power plant is free from the possibility of a meltdown, but nevertheless, the technology exists to make them not foolproof, but at least safe in the worst possible scenario that we are seeing unfold in Japan. And we all know that the Price-Anderson Act was passed in order to indemnify utilities against nuclear accidents, meaning the taxpayer has to pick up the tab. Otherwise, the industry wouldn't have even got off first base. So when you ran the TVA, were you aware that there were people saying that, you know, we can do a whole lot better with nuclear power?
Listen, I've followed this subject for a longer time than that. Let's get all the way back to the beginning. We dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and Harry Truman said, you know, we got to make something good out of this god-awful thing. And so out of a guilt trip, we decided that we had to have atoms for peace. Remember, this was Eisenhower's big speech before the UN, and we went all over the world selling the idea of nuclear power because we thought we were doing good. It was, taking plow shares and all those fancy names we had. And it's General Electric that sold these reactors to the Japanese, all of them that are in trouble and all over America. So this was a technology that was made in America, sold all over the world, and it's boomeranging. I mean, I thought we had won the fight against nuclear power after Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. But these folks are almost like a religious cult. The facts don't matter. I mean, nuclear power failed on every count. I laid it out in my book, Winning Our Energy Independence. It was the cost overruns were terrible. I was able to shut down 8 of these reactors in the home of the atomic bomb down there in Tennessee because they were causing rate increases that people couldn't handle. The cost overruns were more than the cost of the Vietnam War by some counts. I thought that put an end to it. In fact, it wasn't Jane Fonda or Ralph Nader that stopped nuclear power 25 years ago. It was the vice president in charge of finance of the utilities who said, you know, we just can't afford these things. And then there was this big bumper sticker that said, no one died at Three Mile Island. But I said, yeah, the nuclear industry died. That reactor was a $1 billion loss over a couple of days. Now we are reminded again that this is a technology that is inherently capable of destroying not only human beings that live around it, but itself. So the debate ought to be over as far as new nuclear plants are concerned, frankly, but it won't be because the media Generally, I've been watching it over the weekend. They're downplaying this incident. They're saying it's really no big deal. It is a huge deal. I mean, a big chunk of the power supply in Japan is dead. And not only that, there is no threshold on radioactivity. All of it hurts a bit, and a whole lot of it hurts a whole lot. And then this points up the fact that it doesn't take a tsunami to knock the hell out of a nuclear power plant. The Achilles heel is the cooling system. We now know that those suckers can't be just shut down. You've got to continue to pour water into them to take away the heat. The problem was that we went above about a 200 megawatt plant, we've got more heat than can be dissipated in the air. And so now all that has to be done, everybody knows it. The secret is out. You just have to kill the cooling system, and you've got the equivalent of a bomb, a Trojan horse bomb. I tell you, I don't know what it's going to take to overcome the power of the nuclear lobby, but hopefully this program and others will help.
Well, I'm astounded, though, at the power of the nuclear lobby that, like Lazarus, comes back from the dead after Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And I would be dumbfounded if they could come back from the dead after this one, which many analysts say is going to be worse than the previous two.
Well, do you really think the Southern Company is going to stop their nuclear power plants? I don't know what's going to stop them. It certainly won't be the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, but Obama, he has a knack of putting a curse on something. He came out for offshore drilling just before the Gulf disaster. He came out for nuclear power in his State of the Union address. And now we have this. I mean, he doesn't seem to get it right on the energy front at all. In fact, very much parallel to Bush's energy policy.
Well, but didn't, again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, former head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Didn't he, Obama, though, up the ante in terms of being pro-nuclear by...
Yeah, he put more money into it than Bush did, yeah.
$36 billion he just promised in loan guarantees. Wall Street won't touch nuclear power. It takes these loan guarantees. So here we are at a time of recession. And you've got the Tea Party talking about big government giveaways, and yet $36 billion just has been promised to the nuclear industry, who are endangering us all.
Well, it seems to me that we want to keep subsidizing the poison. Now, back in the 70s, when this all got rolling real good, we didn't really know how to harness the sun and make electricity out of wind power. Now, we can do it, and we can make lithium batteries that will store the solar power during the day and use it at night, and store the wind power at night and use it during the day. We can have a wholly renewable, reliable electric system without coal or nuclear power. And yet, this lobby, I'm telling you, it's almost like a religious cult. These people, these nuclear sizes. We got one that's the Secretary of Energy, for God's sakes. We need to wake up and recognize that just because somebody's a Democrat doesn't mean they're on the right side of every issue.
Well, I remember and I was actually just watching MSNBC, which is owned by General Electric, and they're supposed to be sort of on the left politically and pro-Democrat, but they were very making clear that they were putting forth the nuclear industry's talking points. And I remember back how the nuclear industry's propagandists were beating up on that very prescient movie, China Syndrome, and on Jane Fonda, and what an absolute pack of lies it was. And then, of course, Three Mile Island happened, and it might as well have been a scene in that movie.
That's true, and now we have an accident that is worse than Three Mile Island already, and we don't know what the end of it will be. But it's already more radiation emitted and more damage, and yet they continue to try to say, well, this is in Japan and this is different. And the same party line that came out after Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. But the difference was that the utility industry just said no to nuclear power after Three Mile Island, because a hard-nosed utility executive is not going to put the company's money and power to supply into a technology that can self-destruct, and where an accident anywhere in the world casts a shadow on your plan. So I would, but there are some executives that I think are just, I call my old friends in the Tennessee Valley nucleaholics. They are just addicted to it. It's almost a test of their manhood somehow or another. I can't explain it, because there's no rational reason why we would be thinking about new nuclear power plants that cost twice as much as they did before when they were too high then. I mean, and now they're trying to sell them, on a power purchase agreement where, you sign up for it, and then when the costs go up, the price goes up, and you end up with nothing at the end of the contract. I mean, this is a nightmare that's come alive, and unfortunately, people are not describing this for what it is. It's worse than Three Mile Island already. And as a result of Three Mile Island, at least back then before it was subsidized this badly, the utility industry that had experienced all these cost overruns just said no on pure economic grounds. Now we have alternative energy supplies that we could go to, that we need to go to. And I don't know. I was told at the White House briefing today the administration was defending their support of nuclear power in America. They're blind to this. I just think it's time we took a lesson from the young people in Egypt and spoke up and just said no. I mean, if this is not a teachable moment to go to renewable energy and efficiency and get off of coal and nuclear power, I don't know what it's going to take.
Well, David Freeman, given that there are 31 of these GE light water plants identical to the ones that are, or almost identical to the ones that are melting down in Japan, a relic like Indian Point, which is near a major population center, clearly should be shut down, and the other plants on earthquake zones should be immediately
closer to home. What about the plant in Northern California, Diablo Canyon? We just discovered a fault line much nearer to that plant. Now, I don't think that you ought to say that the utilities were imprudent in building on these plants, were, after all, licensed and approved by the regulatory authorities. So I would say that we ought to just phase them out physically, but economically, the investments ought to be paid off by the ratepayers as they're paying them now. But let's just, in a very swift but manageable way, shut them down and give that load to new renewable energy projects and get on with the future.
Well, but that's exactly what's been happening. That's what I find extraordinary, that we have been adding megawatts from new wind power to the grid, but there has not been one megawatt of nuclear power added in decades.
Well, that's right. But now the renaissance has been on. And, you know, what really bothers me is that some of my so-called environmental friends have embraced nuclear power because they claim it doesn't emit carbon. Well, now, how can anybody look themselves in the mirror and say that we think that radioactive poison is better than carbon when you have alternatives that are absolutely benign? The worst thing that could happen to a windmill and a solar plant is that it might not work. But it's not going to hurt anybody. These nuclear units, you can't shut them down, because the heat is still there and you need cooling water. So now the terrorists have been, we've underlined the fact that there is a vulnerability to nuclear plants. You don't have to fly an airplane into the reactor and penetrate the reactor. All you got to do is knock out the cooling system and the backup power plants that are lined, that were knocked out by the tsunami. And believe me, there are ways to knock them out short of a tsunami. And in addition to that, there are a lot of nuclear plants designed in this country near earthquakes where they're designed for 7.5. Now, an 8.9 earthquake is, what, 100 times as strong is what they're designed for. So, you know, it's time that, you know, there's one thing that Donald Rumsfeld taught us, only one thing, and that is the phrase, we need to be aware of the things that we don't know, we don't know.
The unknown unknowns.
The unknown unknowns. And that's what we can't get our mind around. We are not smart enough to know all the ways that a nuclear power plant can be destructive and self-destruct. But let me tell you, anything that is inherently as destructive as nuclear power, you know, it will happen over time, and it has happened. And, you know, how many examples of horrendous consequences do we need? But let's just forget about the human toll. What sense does it make to put your money into technology that in order to save lives, you have to destroy the damn technology? I mean, this is Charlie Chaplin's film about modern times staring us in the face.
Again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, former head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the State Energy Czar here in California. We're talking about the ongoing tragedy in Japan, where three nuclear reactors are in various stages of meltdown, all three having had hydrogen explosions, and their cores are exposed. And, when you're running these utilities, what's the explanation for why, for example, the Europeans and the Scandinavians have filters on their venting systems in case of steam having to vent radioactive steam as the Japanese are now doing into the open atmosphere?
They were just a bit more careful than we are. But, you know, if the sucker is inherently capable of being the equivalent of a bomb, let's ask ourselves and let's let it soak in. Why would you build it in the first place? So shouldn't the debate over new nuclear power plants just be over now? But instead, I have yet to hear anyone on the major networks say in plain English that no matter what happens from now on, there are at least three and probably five reactors over there that are stone cold dead. 15% of their power supply just died overnight. You know, a lot of people are not impressed by human tragedy, but they are impressed by financial tragedy. So let's get the money crowd here, together with those of us that care about human beings. We can join forces here. This technology is destructive of the investment itself. I mean, can you imagine a machine that will kill itself? Why would you build it?
Well, it seems, David Freeman, we're getting all kinds of signals out there in the political turmoil that's going on in the world today, and we'll be joined in a little while by a Libyan diplomat who was a translator for Gaddafi. His oil's off the market. Saudi Arabia's starting to look shaky. Bahrain's in a state of revolt. How many times have we heard we've got to get off Middle East oil? I mean, we're hooked on one drug that we go to war for and that's killing us because of it, the CO2, and the other drug or the other delusion is killing us because when it goes wrong, it poisons us.
Let me tell you something. George Shultz was the head of a task force that I sat on in 1971 in the Nixon administration, and we unanimously concluded after a serious study that if we imported more than 10% of our oil, from outside the Western Hemisphere that we had a serious national security problem. Well, we're getting most of our oil imported and a big chunk of it from outside the Western Hemisphere. So this is an issue where presidents as different as Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and Ford, Reagan, the only thing that I think every president has agreed on ever since Nixon is that we need to get off of that dependence on Middle Eastern oil. And yet our addiction to it and the stubborn refusal of General Motors to advance their own electric car 10 years ago has left us to where we're still just dependent on imported oil. And we ship out, well, with the increased prices, it's more than this, but we were shipping out $1 billion a day of money overseas that could be spent on creating jobs in America. So we are so smart that we're dumb.
David Freeman, you mentioned your disappointment of some of the environmental groups for embracing nuclear power as as a part of the solution to global warming. I know.
And some of the legislators that we admire so much were going around begging my old friend, Senator Alexander from Tennessee, for help on the climate change bill in exchange for all this money for nuclear power. There's enough guilt to spread around here. It's not up to me to judge, but it is up to me to tell the truth. And the truth of the matter is that there's been a huge chunk of the environmental movement that have, if they haven't embraced nuclear power, they said they've been willing to cater to it in order to try to get a climate bill passed that wouldn't have done a hell of a lot to help the climate if it was so watered down. So we just need to take a step back or two and ask ourselves, you know, what are we for? And why aren't we fighting for it?
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, David Freeman.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with David Freeman, former head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and New York Power, and the State of California Energy Czar, the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, Energy Insider Shows How. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a former Libyan diplomat who was a translator for Muammar Gaddafi.
Oh, this world is at a tremble with his strength and mighty power. They're sending up to heaven to get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother, be careful how you plan. You're working with the power of God's own holy hand. Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Abubakar Saad, who is a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, where he researches issues related to the history of Iraq and Arab unity. He's originally from Benghazi, Libya. He worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed on as a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. In the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi, and Professor Saad fled the country when the plot fell apart. He's now a U.S. citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abubakar Saad.
Thank you very much.
Now, it looks as though, given the loss of the port of Brega and the general threats from Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, that they will retake the east, and we're coming, is his warning. Apparently, most of the Western military analysts, including the Director of National Intelligence here in the United States, believe that Gaddafi will prevail. So what will stop him?
What will stop him really is the international community, because as we know, Gaddafi has the firepower. He has a larger military. He has better equipment and heavy equipment. He has air force. He has navy. And he's been using all of these against the uprising. So here, the opposition really are willing to actually take him on the ground. They are willing to fight and struggle with against him on the ground as long as they can have some protection in the sky because, you know, it is raining bombs on them. And they don't even own one helicopter to actually defend themselves with it by the air.
So what about, there's been a lot of debate about a no-fly zone, and it feels like the Western powers are dithering while people are being slaughtered, as what happened with Rwanda.
Exactly.
And of course, that was a low-tech massacre with machetes. This one is modern warfare being used against civilian populations, which seems to me to be a kind of moral line that's been crossed in depravity.
Exactly. This is basically what the argument is all about. Sure, you don't want a foreign interference in any sovereign nation. But when you think about it, this sovereign nation is run by a dictator for 42 years, and that dictator has been slaughtering people all along. And now it is open to the whole world to see how what he's doing to his own people. I mean, if you have been watching the news, the city of Zawiya to the west of Tripoli, people were really mowed down, and you know they were totally demolished in the process of just trying to take it over. And this is going to happen to other cities. We have still the city of Misrata, which is about 120 miles to the east of Tripoli, that's still held by the uprising. And I expect another slaughter there too if the international community does not interfere. In the oil ports of Ras Lanuf and Brega, the same story has been repeated again. And sometimes you wonder, as you have mentioned, where is that moral line is going to be drawn? Is it are you concerned about sovereignty or are you concerned about people's lives? That's really, the question you have raised is a really important question that our leaders, not just the United States, the international community leaders, should really think closely to that.
Again, I'm speaking with former Libyan diplomat and translator for Muammar Gaddafi, Abu Bakr Saad. Since you've spent a number of years as Gaddafi's translator, and you clearly got to know him, it seems to me that so much of the way he's been characterized over the years in the Western press as an eccentric and a kind of crazy guy has, in effect, excused the fact that he's a very cold and calculating killer. What was your impression of him? Because he's clearly, he may be crazy, but he's also smart.
You just said it precisely that. He gives you the impression that he is crazy, so you won't take him seriously. But he is extremely calculating. He's extremely smart. He knows what he's doing, and he knows how to steer the situation in his favor. And he has done that. And people who are watching the events since mid-February, that's basically what he has been doing. At first, he had denied completely that there is an uprising in Libya, and gradually he began to regroup and actually go on an attack against them, little by little. And he and his son, Saif, and Libyan television under his control, all of them are saying that these are just a bunch of gangs. These are a bunch of terrorists who belong to Al-Qaeda and all of that, blah, blah, blah. That really is trying to minimize the importance of the popular uprising against him.
Well, the fact that the Arab League has asked for a no-fly zone, I think, may well shame Russia and China out of their objections on the UN Security Council. So it seems that there are moves afoot against him, but there's no, and I it would seem to me that the US boots on the ground are neither likely or particularly welcome. But I don't understand why something more discreet can't be employed to get rid of this guy.
that's the problem here. It is they are not even unified on something discrete. The French and the British are pushing for all kinds of assistance, not just the no-fly zone. They are trying actually to send some weapons and some assistance to the uprising. But at the same time, Germany and the United States are cautioning against it. And the problem is also if you try to use NATO, there are members of NATO who are friends of Gaddafi, like Turkey. The government of Turkey is totally against the no-fly zone. Not just the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians and Chinese, we know that they have interest in Libya and they wanted to. They have a good relationship with Gaddafi and they wanted to maintain that. And for them, Gaddafi's winning is even more boost to their interest in the country. But sometimes those little players who are on the side that people don't pay attention to them, like Turkey and others, that actually will undermine some of these steps if you want to think about it in that particular sense. So when you look at the international community that could take action, they are really fragmented. They are not in one opinion. And actually, I would like to pose to them to the question that you just posed. Let us check morality here. Where is it stands? Are you really concerned about your relationship with a sovereign who is really brutal, or you are concerned about the lives of all of these thousands who have been slaughtered? Because we actually don't know how many people have been killed so far in Libya.
Sure, and if everybody's
estimating.
Sure, and if Gaddafi were to roll back the rebels in the east, there would be a huge massacre, and thousands of people would escape into Egypt, creating enormous refugee problems.
Not only that, the city of Benghazi has close to 1 million people. You know, just imagine if he attacked that 1 million people with his air force and his heavy weapons. You're going to see a tremendous amount of casualties there and loss of life and loss of property and everything. So here, I mean, you know, so far, actually, most of the fighting was in the smaller cities. But you're talking about the second largest city in the country. And that's really a scary prospect that it would be a big shame for the international community to let such a thing happen. They should intervene before he advances. And the problem is he knows that they are not, they are undecided, and he's taken advantage of this time, and that's why he is pushing so hard, and he's bombarding by sea, he's bombarding by air, he's bombarding by land, and he's trying to push a way through before the international community can get their act together.
So, again, I'm speaking with former Libyan diplomat and translator for Gaddafi, Abu Bakr Said. And is there any possibility of? I mean, he's not beloved by anybody. He's supported by his own tribe, and he's got the women bodyguards around him and a lot of security, and then he's got these African mercenaries. So you've got sort of three rings of security. But what about when you say that he controls the television? I mean, surely some people must know that the Arab League, for example, has turned against him. The world has turned against him. Is there any way to break his hold over his followers? Or secondly, is there any way for the Egyptians to send in some team of special forces or somebody that can help these rebels get rid of the head of the snake, as it's often described?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, your idea is, definitely is plausible. But the problem is, how can you get those people to act that way? He is well entrenched. He not only has his own whole tribe, he also has some loyal people who have been benefiting from his system, who have been benefiting from his regime, are those the ones who are standing by him. And you have to realize here, if you cut the head of the snake, the rest of the snake's body is going to be mutilated. And that's what they are afraid of. They say, would rather protect the head of the snake so we won't be lost too, because they know that they have no place to go if he goes.
Well, then, what kind of percentage of the population are we talking about here?
It's a very small percentage, but it is well equipped, well trained, well armed, and other people don't have any of these arms. So that's the thing. That's his military and his militia. Actually, his militia is who are really protecting him. He calls them the popular committees. Those are better trained and better equipped than his own military, than the army. So those are the ones who are fiercely loyal to him. Also, those mercenaries he brings from all over the world, particularly from Africa, they are well paid by him. And he is really used to spend lavishly on his militia and his army. So these people are benefiting from his system. They are not large in percentage. They don't even present about 10% of the population. But that 10% is heavily armed and heavily equipped.
Right, and his son Hamis runs the 32nd Brigade, which is supposedly the best trained and equipped unit.
Exactly, and that's what he did. Basically, he sent his son to Zawiya first, destroyed Zawiya, and as soon as he destroyed Zawiya, he turned east. And now he is the one who is actually attacking Ras Lanuf and Brega. See, the news we are getting that he is the one who's, his brigade is the one that they are facing now. So that's why they wanted the air protection so they can make a dent in that brigade. If they can defeat that brigade and make a dent in it, the other brigades are easier to take care of. And that's why the oppositions are saying, just protect us from the sky and we will take care of the ground.
And so far, the sky, because I've been reading reports that there's very little military equipment amongst the freedom fighters, and they often group around the one guy with military training, making them an easy target for Gaddafi's bombs.
Exactly. That's the problem. But they do have the courage to fight. Even if the reporters who are there, they say, their enthusiasm is really tremendous.
Well, look, I thank you for joining us here today. I'm afraid we've run out of time. But thank you so much for joining us, Abu Bakr Saad.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with former Libyan diplomat and translator for Muammar Gaddafi, Abu Bakr Saad. He is now professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, and he's originally from Benghazi, Libya. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter, our associate producer, Samantha Su Mong Pong. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog, so you can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog, and you can leave comments, and I'd love to know what you think. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.